Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. This Friday is something like a starting pistol for holiday shoppers. The day after Thanksgiving is the busiest day of the year for merchants and the time when people across this country pull out the credit card and push up their share of consumer debt. An investigation of the credit card industry shows that close to 90 million cardholders choose not to pay off the money they owe. They make a small payment, often at unusually high interest rates, and then they roll over the debt to another month, and another payment, and so on. These people, we're told, are called the revolvers, and they're the ones who make the credit card business a lucrative one. Just how lucrative and how powerful the industry is brought to light in a Frontline documentary that's being aired on PBS stations tonight. It's called The Secret History of the Credit Card. And we'll be talking with the reporter, Lowell Bergman. We'd like to hear from you on this program. The banks that control our credit cards certainly have the upper hand when it comes to setting rates and rules and fees. Do you think they have too much power? Should there be more regulation of the way credit cards treat consumers? Or are consumers the ones to blame with our inability to restrain ourselves from pulling out that plastic card? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lowell Bergman has won a number of awards for his investigative work, taking on such difficult topics as the tobacco industry, illegal drugs, terrorism, and government corruption. He's joining us from Berkeley, California. Hi, Lowell.
Good morning.
I want to know, in all your investigative reporting and trying to get people to talk to you, how you'd rate the characters in this story for their willingness to speak out about the credit card industry.
One of the surprising things in trying to research and report this story is the number of people, particularly middle-class people, who are holding credit card debt, that is the revolvers you described, who just would tell you quietly in a corner what their situation was, but were too embarrassed to go public. And I'm not talking about the people who we do have on camera. We did get some people together. I'm talking about FBI officials. I'm talking about university professors, journalists, in particular journalists. I was really surprised at the number of journalists, young and old, my age, who are revolving credit card users, who are financing, let's say, their parts of their lives that they really probably can't afford.
You also had some considerable difficulty getting the banks to put people up who talk about or to explain what they're doing with their credit cards.
Well, they put up Mr. Yingling, who's in the documentary, who's the head of the American Banking Association. He's the incoming head. And their chief lobbyist. The industry has itself declined to cooperate, and a representative of MBNA said to me not so long ago that if we go along with this and help you do this documentary, it'll help make it possible.
And they didn't want
that.
Lowell, I should probably make it clear that the revolvers that we've been mentioning, the people who don't pay off their balance at the end of each month and make a minimum payment or a portion of that payment, they're really the ones who keep the industry going, aren't they?
As it turns out, in the economics, you would expect that people who are good customers are the people who pay their bills off or pay off in full. In fact, in the world of credit cards, if you pay off every month, you're called a deadbeat inside the industry. In other words, what they make off of you is that very small amount percentage on the transaction fee, which really is split up. The bank itself only gets a percentage of that percentage. And they have to maintain the card. They have a lot of advertising and other expenses. And so to make money, to make real money, the kinds of record profits that they've been making, they have to get people paying high interest rates and high fees, especially over the last 8 years.
Now, your story takes us a little bit further into how these rates can be adjusted without people being aware of it. I think the industry term is universal default, but can you explain that for us, what it actually means for us?
Well, you've gotten a credit card, right?
Yeah.
You have some?
Yeah, two.
So when you have two. So when you get them in the mail, you have a contract that comes with it. You ever read it?
No.
Okay. So they have disclosed to you the terms of the deal. I mean, in some ways, it's not that different than a lot of other contracts you probably have signed if you have a mortgage or so on. There's a lot of fine print. In the case of the credit card contract, what makes it really different in almost all cases is that there's a clause in there that says that we reserve the right to change the terms of this agreement, period.
With,
that means that
with
they
what
can
kind
change
of notification?
Any,
with what kind of consultation?
Generally, it's a 15-day written notification, another long document in fine print that you'll get in the mail if you bother to read it. Because, as we explain in the documentary, the history of what's happened here is the United States has no effective cap on interest rates. You may remember the concept of usury in the Bible. Well, that no longer exists in the United States. It's one of the few countries in the world where that has been eliminated through not a direct act, but a combination of different circumstances that took place 25 or so years ago, a Supreme Court decision, and then some things that were going on in the economy. So effectively, they can change your interest rate, for instance, after the fact, retroactively, on something you've already bought, to any rate they deem likely or probable or useful to them. And I'm talking about interest rates. They may indicate on your contract or mailing 19% as a default rate or 25.99 or 29.99. In fact, as the Federal Reserve rates have slowly crept up, we now see penalty interest rates reaching 41%.
41%?
And they could go higher.
Because there are no limits in the places where they've chosen to anchor themselves, the states where they that they call home.
Well, the way the legal system as it happened was that there was a Supreme Court decision that said that a bank in one state could export its interest rate to any other state and collect it in another state. Traditionally, interest rates have been set by state legislatures around the country, and usually they reflected what the local community thought was an interest rate that was either loan sharking or usury or some other pejorative way of describing a lending relationship. The fact is that what happened in 25 years ago is that Federal Reserve interest rates were up into the 14% realm. State interest rate caps in New York, where most of the banks were, around 12%. So the banks couldn't make money in that situation. They went looking for an alternative. They found the state of South Dakota, which had just removed all of its caps on usury rates. And that's why your Citibank bill is mailed from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and why you send it there.
Now, there's a lot more about the way that those rates can be manipulated, and we'll get into that later in the program. But one of the other things that you highlight here, Lowell, are the fees. This project that you worked on is, I should point out, not just a PBS exercise, but something that involved work with the New York Times as well. And in the Times piece, I think I took the number $11.7 billion in fees charged by the credit card companies.
I'll check your numbers, but the fee income from credit cards has doubled over the last 6 years, and that's primarily because in 1996, just like in the interest rate situation, in the fee situation, they got a Supreme Court decision which basically lifted all state restrictions on fees, supposedly to make it a national marketplace. However, Congress did not come in and say, you can't charge any more than this. So you have late fees that went from $5 to $10 to $39. You have over-the-limit fees. Just look at your contract.
Right.
It'll list all the different varieties of fees that they can charge.
These are over-limit fees or late check fees or finance charges, something that I saw recently, foreign currency conversion fees above and beyond what the credit cards themselves were charging. I mean, that was sort of a bank fee on top of a card fee.
Right. Well, they're in the business of making money, and the situation, literally, and the situation is that the market has been effectively deregulated and is about to actually be deregulated in a certain way in terms of consumer protection from the government, so that the industry is actually out there with very few rules and very few things except the market behavior of consumers to control it.
Let's hear for a couple of moments from Tony Yaser. He's been listening along. He's a professor of economics at George Washington University. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
You use credit cards, I assume.
Yes, I do.
Do you pay them off at the end of the month?
Yes. And actually, I must say the reference to most people carrying an outstanding balance doesn't coincide with what I've seen when I use the Survey of Consumer Finances. According to that, most people actually do pay off their balance, and certainly carrying balances of thousands of dollars is not something that we see as the rule in at least the national surveys of consumer finances.
What would you say, though, to consumers who say that they find themselves caught by unusually high interest rates. Do you blame the credit card companies? Do you blame the consumers?
If we get away from credit and we just talk about any sort of market, let's say I'm buying furniture. There are stores that sell shoddy merchandise at high prices and stores that sell excellent merchandise at reasonable prices. As an intelligent consumer, I should avoid the former and patronize the latter. In the same way, when it comes to credit cards, if you shop for credit, which you can do at very low cost, it's a highly competitive industry, you can avoid the shoddy merchandise at high prices. By the way, I suggest that rather than two credit cards, you should actually have four, two of which you use rather seldom. Just rotate them in. Then if any of these companies treat you badly in any single way, you can simply send them a note telling them they can rectify the situation or you will cut up their credit card. I think you will find a favorable response, but if you don't, cut up the card and use the other credit card.
Let me check back with Lowell here. Lowell, Tony Yaser is saying that we can actually shop around for a card that's going to treat us well. And I mean, goodness, I get, you know, stacks of mail from people telling me that if I take their credit card, they'll give me 0% interest. Is that, I mean...
Yeah, that's their worst nightmare. I mean, the people that we interviewed in the industry, consultants and others, and by the way, there's an extensive website with frontline.org that'll be up today. What the professor is saying is true. If you want to and have the time and the knowledge to move around from card to card, use, for instance, the 0% come on and make sure you understand the deadlines or any limitations to it and then move to another 0%, it becomes a kind of Las Vegas game where you are playing games with the credit card companies. And some people do that and do that quite successfully and don't create profit for the industry as a result. But the industry's record profits are not based upon the fact that consumers are doing that in a way that really affects their bottom line. It turns out that they're making record profits. And they're doing that because they understand statistically from what they've told us and some of their consultants have told us, they expect that if you are paying your bills off every month, that you will be late at least, if you're one of those, if you will, deadbeats, you will be late at least once a year. So they'll get that $35 on top of everything else from almost every one of their customers. If you're what they call a subprime lender, that is, you have a low balance allowed and you're already paying high fees to have the card, that is, you're a greater credit risk, you'll be late 2.5 times a year. So fee collection has been a source of revenue for the cards. But there's no question, because of the free market nature of it, you can, as an individual, game the system.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, a chance for you to join in on this conversation as we take a look at the relationship between credit card companies, the banks that manage them, and the consumers who try to make sense of the differing rates on the interest payments that may be required and may, in fact, change without a whole lot of notice. Do you think it's a fair fight? Do you think consumers are to blame when they get themselves in too much trouble with the credit cards? Or are they being drawn into a plastic trap by companies that have the upper hand? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Tonight at 9 o'clock on most PBS stations, there's going to be a documentary aired called The Secret History of the Credit Card. The reporter who's in charge of that one is Lowell Bergman. You'll know him from his work taking on Big Tobacco and a number of other investigative reporting jobs that he's done over time. He's my guest this hour. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We want to make sure we get our callers in. So let's go straight to Columbia, South Carolina for our first call. And Joe's with us. Hi, Joe. I'm fine, thanks. What are you thinking?
Well, I have MBNA as my primary credit card, and I have a $10,000 limit. And so I had a balance of about $5,000, and it was financed at about 9% interest, maybe 10%. I'm not looking at the records.
Yeah.
So they sent to my mailbox a bunch of checks and said, you know, go spend this other $5,000 that you have available, and we'll give it to you for 4% interest. So, you know, I have a shop, so I decided to go ahead and invest in some machinery, that being the deal. then the very next month, I get my credit card statement in, and sure enough, it was at the 4% interest, but the previous balance that was financed at 9% had gone to 21% interest.
With what kind of explanation, Joe?
Yeah, so I called them up, and they said that occasionally they run through your credit and find out, you know, whether you're a better credit risk or a worse credit risk, and it seems that that month they had found that I was a worse credit risk, so in their small print, they're allowed to do that to you. So I just felt like they had just cheated me. I mean, why offer me $5,000 to go spend at this low interest rate so that then that would throw my credit score down a little bit where they'd be able to go ahead and jack the rest of it up?
Tony Yaser from George Washington. I mean, this is a sort of story that comes up in the PBS documentary, precisely. Are you saying that the credit card companies are treating people like Joe fairly when they do this?
Well, first, I mean, I don't know the detailed circumstances, but undoubtedly, as I said, there are purveyors of shoddy merchandise at high prices, and the marketplace provides you with a defense, and that's to go elsewhere, to transfer this balance.
But MBNA is not some little dark shack on the back tracks here. This is a big, serious corporation,
and,
one of the major players.
And I believe that if they are treating people this way, and if people write them, the management, a little note, and then transfer their balance, that this practice will stop relatively quickly because they will become very unpopular. So I would urge this gentleman to do that, and I applaud attempts to publicize this sort of behavior because certainly the credit risk implications going from 9 to 21% are that you'd have to have a major deterioration in your credit score to justify that.
Unfortunately,
so,
go ahead, Lowell.
Basically, I find this to be an unattractive business practice, but the market has a way of dealing with that. That is, you go elsewhere and you write management a note and tell them exactly what they've done and why you're going elsewhere.
Lowell Bergman.
The problem is that, first of all, that even the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is in charge of national banks, has made notice and an advisory of practices like this. They have not moved to stop it, and they've been making advisories like this for a year and a half. So concerning the whole industry being involved in these practices, and as we reported in the New York Times, their own consultants, industry's consultants, say that this type of practice is on the rise. And is a record right now in terms of how the whole industry behaves. But the real catch in here is that, yes, the gentleman in question could shift his balance, but the problem is that his credit score has already been affected by his relationship with MBNA. And it is not necessarily true that there's another major credit card bank that would assume the balance at the rates that he once had now that he's where he is. He's in a disadvantage in trying now to renegotiate credit with another company. And so that's the practice that goes on, and particularly when people get in difficult financial straits and they keep running up balances to live on and their balance gets higher and higher, they're less likely to be able to find another credit card issuer who will take their transferred balance now that their overall financial situation seems to be deteriorating.
What would you say to Joe are his chances of sending off a note to the head office of MBNA and saying this ain't right?
Well, I know MBNA in particular is listening very carefully to this broadcast and the program tonight, just because I've had some interaction with their management over the last couple of days. We do have someone in the program himself who, by giving a number of interviews, has had his rate, a small businessman, gone back down to its original rate and adjusted by the president of NBNA. But I think that the other problem is that normally if you didn't get redress from the company itself, you might go to some place like the Better Business Bureau or your local, let's say, state attorney general, which may have a consumer affairs office. What is happening, and it hasn't completely happened yet today, is that the federal government and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency are in the process of taking all jurisdiction over consumer complaints away from the states and putting it in the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Now, that's a little difficult because they don't put their name on your bill, and nobody knows who they are or how to contact them.
I just want to go back to Joe in Columbia and check with you, Joe. Have you got any sense of satisfaction or any hints from the feedback that you're giving MBNA that you've got a problem with them?
No, not at all. And in fact, just what your guest said happened to me, and that is once this happened, I tried to get some kind of satisfaction and nothing. So then I approached other credit companies who said the letters that I got in the mail said that essentially because I had tapped out my credit line, they wouldn't extend credit. So had I not borrowed the second $5,000 from MBNA, they would have been happy to give me a new card with a $10,000 limit at 0% interest. So in fact, what I did was hurt myself.
All right, Joe, I thank you for your call. Good luck with sorting that all out. Now, I need to sort of move some pieces around on the board here. I want to bring in another guest, but to do that, I'm going to say to Tony Yaser at George Washington University, thanks for your time. It's good to have you on the program.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tony's a professor of economics there. Linda Sherry is joining us now. She's editorial director of Consumer Action. And, Linda, I wanted to bring you in here because I know you were listening to the story that Joe was telling us here, and it also comes up in the work that Lowell has done, that it seems like, you know, it's just one pebble in the pond and then everybody piles on. You all of a sudden your credit rating goes down with everybody.
Yes, this is very true. Consumers now dealing with credit card companies, it's the classic David and Goliath story. The professor said you can vote with your feet, but, you know, there's no voting with your feet once you've gotten in this cycle because no other company wants you anymore. So they've effectively branded you as somebody with, handling your credit poorly, and then nobody else wants you. Plus, if you have very, very large balances anyway, and even if you haven't gotten into this trap, carrying a large balance, other banks do not wish to transfer balances above $10,000 in most cases.
And Linda, I know that your organization has been tracking the credit card industry for some 15 years now. When you hear Lowell describing what he's watching just in the last couple of years, are these the points that you're zeroing in on, places where you think that the people running the managing the credit cards are being unduly tough on consumers?
I do think they are. And I think, listening to Lowell, I think he's been following our surveys over the years because these are things we have found year after year. As we ask the questions of the credit card companies, we have also identified that some credit card companies are worse than others at doing things. Some credit card companies are particularly hard for consumers to deal with. This could turn into, I suppose, to an MBNA bashing show, but I don't want it to be that. But I have to say that as a surveyor of credit card rates and fees, et cetera, over the years, and I've done it since 94, MBNA is one of the banks that really doesn't want to help much. In fact, I really suspect that maybe they don't understand why they should listen to consumers or their advocates.
Although I, too, have been looking at some of the stuff that your organization has been writing, and I find Bank One and Chase and Discover and Fleet Cards, now Bank of America cards, also getting marked. I want to get back to some of our callers, hear what they have to say to us. Let's go to Maynard, Massachusetts next. Suzanne's on the line. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I actually should have given a fake name, I think.
That's all right. Your identity is safe with me.
Okay. I am a credit card revolver by disposition, and I know this because I used to have a credit card balance of over $10,000, which I paid off, and mm-hmm. I actually had no credit card for 3 years. And boy, was life difficult. I couldn't when I didn't have a card, it was difficult to check in at an airline. It was difficult to make online purchases.
You can't rent a car.
No, you can't rent a car. You can't make reservations. And so I got a credit card again. And I set a limit for myself rather than accepting the limit that the company would give me. And I set my limit at $2,000, and I promptly charged myself up to $2,000 just because it was easy. It's easy to leave the balance on. And I have...
So, Suzanne, it really sort of raises a fundamental point here about who's to blame here. Is it reasonable to point the finger at the credit card companies for whatever their practices are? Or do consumers have to bear a certain amount of responsibility here for, you know, our own bad habits?
To be quite honest, I do take 90% of the blame, but it's really difficult to live a life without a credit card. And once you have a credit card, you know, you have it, and it's there, and it sometimes feels like free money, which is also, you know, the credit card holders is to be blamed for using it as, you know, it's not free money.
Well, Bergman, I know that this is one of the things that you wrestled with in the piece. Who are the bad guys here, really?
Well, the fact that we live beyond our means and that the value system in the country has changed. I mean, when we talk on the one hand of a rise of faith and religion in this country, yet we get rid of a religious-based prescription on, for instance, interest rates, and no one notices it. Or we had a tradition of saving and watching how much you spent. And that has been revolutionized in the last 25 years. When you see credit card ads, you see people who want you to spend more, borrow more, live, if you will, the good life, even if you can't afford it. And it's that ethos that's out there that many people are living through, and sometimes tragically, sometimes, you know, having a wonderful time. Mm-hmm. But that's the way it goes. I mean, that's the way the system is operating. And the credit card industry provides the convenience. You don't have to go down to a loan officer and show them prove how much money you make in order to get a credit card or get credit. And on the other hand, it's incredibly convenient and necessary to do things in our daily lives.
I'm wondering, Linda, in your own perspective, whether or not you look at this balance here and think that the credit card companies may have gone too far in terms of, you know, putting in these fees for, you know, late payment and all these other things that Lowell and I were talking about a little bit earlier, or do we cut them some slack and say we're our own worst enemy?
Well, first of all, I mean, consumers really do have to take responsibility for their own financial management, personal financial management. But the credit card companies have really, as Lowell says, piggybacked on the rampant consumerism in this country today. And they like to say to people, spend, spend, spend. But then they like to say, gotcha, you know. And it's that gotcha that people can't understand, because in many cases, with some of the new policies that are coming forward, which you've mentioned already, the universal default policy, for instance, on the cards, which they raise your rate when you're late with another card, people just can't understand this. They're just scratching their heads. They're like, but I was never late with this card. So many people feel they are holding up their end mm-hmm. of the deal.
Well, I suspect that's the sort of thing that we might hear from Don, who's on the line now from Mason, Michigan. Don, does that describe the situation that you had?
Well, I just received a bill yesterday that my credit card company had not received my last payment, so they tacked on a $39 late fee. I called the credit card company, which, by the way, was one company a month ago, bought by a new bank this month, and my first payment to the new bank is lost in the mail.
And what happens when you call them and explain that?
Well, they said send us a new check. Pay the $39 late fee, cancel your check at the bank, which costs another $25, and they'll consider it when they receive my money. I should call them back in 30 days or so.
I guess I'm wondering, Don, whether or not you feel that you're a customer of the credit card company or a client, or whether or not you're getting that kind of treatment from them.
Well, initially, can I say the credit card bank?
Yeah, sure, why not?
It was People's Bank out of Connecticut. I got 8.9% interest on it, and it's been that way for the last 5 years. Never went up, never went down. Great. The new company comes in, the very first payment I send. Well, they treated me as a customer, I guess.
What this reminds me of, Lowell, are the people that you interviewed, and then there were a number of them, who said, you know, I was a really good customer. I was always on time. I was, you know, making my payments when I should. And then this happened. Are people wrong to think that they actually develop a long-term business relationship with their credit card company?
I think it depends on the policies of the company at a particular time. But one of the consultants, Andrew Carr, who we interview in the documentary, and who's a longer version of his interview is online at the Frontline website, describes the kind of computerization, if you will, of policies, the standardization of policies, particularly collection policies and what people are allowed to say at the other end of the phone and their, when you call them up. And so they have standard policies that they try to regulate as much as possible, and they don't allow their people a lot of leeway in terms of making a deal with you or changing things. It's really a question of, can they afford to lose you as a client? That's the biggest problem for credit card companies. If you threaten to move, it's going to cost them money, hundreds of dollars to find a new client to replace you. So that's the only place as an individual you really have any leverage with them.
And so that's, I mean, that's something Tony was saying earlier. It matters. It matters for you to threaten.
To the companies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Generally speaking, it'll matter unless their policy indicates from your situation that you're a loser for them in some fashion, and all they really want to do is close down your account and get you to pay it off.
And in a conversation,
before you go bankrupt, and then they get nothing.
Now, in a conversation that you had with one of my colleagues here at The Connection, you said that you would qualify as a deadbeat, the sort of person who pays his balance off at the end of each month. Does that mean that if you got into trouble with a credit card company, they just sort of cut you loose because you're not really making them a whole lot of money, Lowell?
Well, if you're what we learned this term deadbeat, if you're someone who pays off every month, what they're waiting for is for you to eventually have a balance or be late. And they'll treat you fine for a while as long as you keep making your payments and as long as they don't see you pick up somewhere that you're doing something that makes them feel like you've become riskier. Now, let me explain this. Over the last 25 years, while this has all been going on, the other key thing that's happened is that we have in the United States the most advanced financial record system on every person in this country. And that information is shared by the various companies through credit reporting agencies and something called FICO, so they can tell what you're doing.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back after the break. We're going to step away for just a couple of moments and come back, talk more about credit cards, credit card debt. We'd like to hear from you, your experiences dealing with the companies. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about credit cards, the history of the credit card, how we use credit cards, an appropriate time to be having the conversation on the week when people are supposed to be trooping off for one of the busiest shopping days of the year at the end of this week. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Lowell Bergman is with us. He's the frontline correspondent and New York Times reporter who put together the story, The Secret History of the Credit Card, which you can see on television in most areas around 9 o'clock this evening. And we also have with us Linda Sherry. She is editorial director of Consumer Action, a national nonprofit consumer education and advocacy group, joining us on the line from Washington. Before we go back to our calls, I just wanted to return, Lowell, if I could, for a moment with you on the FICO number that you were talking about when we went to the break. Is this something that most people are aware of? I'm not.
Yeah, most people apparently aren't aware that 75% of the adults in the United States eligible for credit have a FICO score. And this is a new development over the last 15 years. And basically, what it means is that we all – it's a much more important number than your SAT ever was.
Does it mean that the cable television company and the phone company and all the other people who are contemplating doing business with me can get access to my FICO score?
Exactly. And it's becoming much more prevalent even with utility companies and others determining what it's supposed to represent as a mathematical formula is your willingness to pay, not how much money you make.
Right.
But the fact that you make your payments, and it's generally based on report detailed information that comes from the three major credit reporting agencies, but it may in fact have other information that's crunched in there in the numbers. And this has been critical to this process of what we're talking about of the universal default, because the industry gets access to this number. They regularly, if you will, graze for numbers on their accounts, mm-hmm. and in particular this number. And when they find out that it's changed, that's when you get the 15-day notice, for example, that your interest rate just went up.
Linda Sherry, can we find out what our FICO number is? And if we can we appeal it or ask to have it changed?
Well, yes, you can. Question number one, you can find it out for sure. And question number two, can you change it? It changes. It can change every day, really, depending on what you do with your credit. But you certainly can go into the underlying document from which all these credit scores are pulled, and that's called your credit report. That's held by three large companies, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, and you can go there. And coming very soon, we'll be able to get one free copy a year if we don't already live in a state that gives us that right.
You have to pay for your FICO score, though.
The FICO score, unfortunately, will not be free. The government did not have the foresight to make that free, too. We will still be paying for our scores. The score costs about $12.95 at this point. But I highly recommend that people get it from at least one company, because then you'll know what you're up against. If you think that the score seems wrong for you, then you can actually get the credit report, look at it, and there may be errors. These credit reports are rife with error. And studies have been shown by USPIRG, et cetera, that there are just so many errors on these reports that people can correct.
Let's go to Wellesley, Massachusetts, for our next call. Another Linda is waiting on the line there. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's your what have you got to tell us this morning?
Well, I was just saying I used to work for an advertising agency that my part of my job was to do credit card direct mail all day long, all year long. I did credit card direct mail. And one of the last projects that I worked on was one of several mailings that were each going to be about 40 million pieces per mailing, say three a year. And it was for a credit card that was 21 points above prime. And I laughed out loud. I was in a meeting, and I was in Boston, and the bank was in Texas. And I laughed. I said, nobody's going to take that. I said, who would pay 21 points above prime? I don't even have any credit card debt, which I don't, and I didn't then. And everybody was silent in Boston and in Texas. They couldn't believe it. And after that, I did sort of an informal survey of my friends and acquaintances, because I thought everybody paid their – I really did. That's how I don't talk about it, but I thought everybody paid their debts off, their credit cards off. And, I had – the answers that I got were among – the answers were, oh, I tried to pay for my college education with my credit card, and I fell behind, and I went bankrupt, and now I'm doing this or, some other job. And then one woman had to pay for her husband's brain surgery with her credit card.
So what was the explanation, Linda, as to why somebody would want to sign up for a credit card that was 20 points above prime?
Right, because that was the only credit they could get. And I couldn't, I'm talking from the experience of having done, that was only one project that I was doing, but I did that all day long. I did 20 credit cards a week, like 20 a week, different kinds of gasoline credit cards, store credit cards. This is like my whole job was to do this.
Jump in here, Lowell.
The industry spends $4 billion a year on direct mail marketing. And $1 billion on advertising in general. That's why you see their ads everywhere. They don't like to reveal it. There's no limit on the interest or where it may go. They don't like to tell you who to appeal to if you have a complaint. And they don't like to tell you my favorite ads actually in all of this research we were doing was there was a series of ads running where it's identity theft type ad where they're defending you against fraud.
Okay.
I think you've probably seen those where people, seem to be surfing, but it's an elderly black gentleman sitting there and at home. And what they don't want to tell you, for instance, is that under federal law, there's a $50 limit on what you're liable for if someone commits fraud or you dispute a charge, period. You don't need any special consideration other than the industry doing exactly what it's doing, which is develop very high-tech ways of discovering fraud going on, but that's to protect themselves.
So what they're selling is something that we already have?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I'd just like to say one last thing, and that is that I was listening to the program while I was waiting to come on, and, my diligence in paying off my credit cards has paid off, because when I went for a mortgage, a refinance for my mortgage, they did, I gave my Social Security number, and they brought up all these numbers, and my credit rating is in the top 0.1% of the country. I don't have any – people are dying to lend me money as much as I want because I pay my bills off.
That's the secret. That's the secret to having a good credit score, is pay all your bills on time and don't carry a lot of credit.
To Yorktown, Virginia next, and Jeff's joining us from there. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
I appreciate what the last caller had to say, because we're in a very similar situation. Back when I was in college, I had accumulated quite a bit of credit card debt, found myself in a lot of trouble, and I was up to my ears. Later in life, more recently, not 10 or 15 years ago, my wife and I decided for, personal and ethical reasons that we wanted to do away with credit card debt. And as a result, we paid off all of our credit cards, cut them up, got rid of everything, and the only debt we have now is our mortgage. And our credit scores are so high now that we're in the same situation, like I said, as the last caller, where, you know, people are dying to lend us money. But the thing is that our lives, the quality of our life has improved so much because we're not worried about making late payments or spending so much of our money in interest and things like that. It's just, to answer the question about whose fault is it, being the consumer or the credit card, I definitely take a whole lot of responsibility for that. And we're so used to having everything we want in this society. So anyway, I guess that's the point that I was trying to get to.
It's interesting, and Linda, Sherry, maybe you can just sort of weigh in on this. Though it's kind of sad when you think that people, in order to control it, have to like cut up the cards because it's so hard to manage all the numbers when you're trying to deal with it. I mean, I don't think that this is just greed we're talking about here.
No, I definitely think there is a problem with that. I mean, earlier this year, there was a survey by Cambridge Credit Counselors that found that fewer people were paying in full. In 1 year, it was at 39% of people were paying in full, and a year before it was 43%. Now, that shows me that more and more people are finding it difficult to avoid the temptation or avoid, you know, not pay in full every month. So that's very, there's a segment of the credit card industry called reward cards, and they supposedly give you back something, rebates or rewards. But what they also encourage you to do is run through huge balances every month, which ostensibly you may be able to pay if you're affluent. If you can't pay, suddenly you've got this, you know, huge balance looming over your head.
One of the parachutes here, Lowell, and it's referred to in the work that you did, is the opportunity to file for personal bankruptcy if you find yourself in one of these frightening spirals where you can't pay your debt and you've got no income. And it leads us to a piece of legislation which is pending, the bankruptcy reform. This is a part of the story that's worth paying attention to as well.
Well, first of all, remember, bankruptcy is in the Constitution of the United States. Mm-hmm. It's a fundamental part of our rights. And bankruptcy is a last resort that people are taking more and more. There are somewhere around 10% of the families in the United States have gone bankrupt over the last 7 years. In almost all of those cases, there is credit card debt involved. The credit card industry, seeing this increasing defaulting going on people paying them, put forward with others this legislation, which has been pending for some time. And basically what it will do is it will take credit card debt and it will survive bankruptcy in the way that alimony or student loans or your IRS bill would survive bankruptcy. Now, that bill passed actually both houses of Congress. The industry has bipartisan support. Back in 2000, Hillary Clinton convinced, as the story goes, her husband to veto it. It was a pocket veto. The bill has been reintroduced. It wasn't pushed during the election campaign. It appears, from what we understand, that it will take front burner status soon when Congress reconvenes. It's likely to pass with a large majority, and the president has said he's going to sign it.
And you made the point in a piece you wrote some months back about the amount of political clout that companies like MBNA have. I mean, they give a tremendous amount of money to the political parties.
Well, until we wrote that story back earlier this year, and this is the joint New York Times Frontline Project, MBNA had been the largest single contributor to the political career of George W. Bush. Now, it was also a very large contributor. It's changed since the article ran, apparently, that they cut back on their contributions politically in general. But the financial services industry, which the credit card industry is part of, is the biggest spender in Washington as a group, on everything from lobbying to political contributions. And they have the Democratic Party, generally speaking, and the Republican Party in Congress behind them.
And so, Linda, if we have the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and we have the Better Business Bureau and we have organizations like Consumer Action, I mean, do consumers really have much of a chance against this kind of financial and political muscle?
Well, consumers always have a chance, and I believe that we should sometimes go back to some of the things we did in the past as consumer protesters like picketing, et cetera. Unfortunately, I call this a sort of a disease in this country today, which is consumer apathy. We're incredibly busy, two families, both couples work, et cetera, trying to keep up. People don't have a lot of time for activism. On the other hand, you know, we do have to be a little fearful of all the money that the financial services industry is pouring into Congress to get things to go their way. There, you know, when people, when lawmakers want to perhaps go and sit on the Financial Services Committee, they don't want to do that because they have consumers' best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. They actually want to sit there so they can get more campaign contributions from that quarter. So I think we really do need to, as individual consumers, join up, link up with some groups, not only Consumer Action, but there's lots of good consumer groups out there who will be your voice, who will actually be fighting for you in Washington, D.C., if you support them and you stay in communication with them.
Although, Lowell, when I hear Linda talking about people not having a lot of time, I mean, it in many ways is why people find themselves paying 21, 24, 29% on their credit card bill because they just don't take the time to look at the darn thing.
Let me point out that the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, in the interviews that we did with them, tells us straightforwardly there is nothing they, as the regulator of national banks, can do about your fees or your interest rate and changes, if you will, how high they're going to go. So nobody can regulate that except Congress at this point. And there's nothing in sight. There was a minor blimp back in 1991 where the Senate started to discuss such legislation on a Friday. It was gone as anything on the agenda by Monday. So the basics of this industry are not going to change politically anytime in the near future.
Lowell, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Lowell Bergman is frontline correspondent, New York Times reporter, and the documentary The Secret History of the Credit Card airs tonight on PBS. We'll also have a link on our website, too. I think it's frontline.org, which will give you more information and background information about that piece. Linda Sherry, I want to thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Linda is editorial director for Consumer Action. Earlier in the program, we talked with Tony Yaser, economics professor at George Washington University. The Connection's produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Sugarts, and Kevin Sullivan. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.